Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. military continues dropping humanitarian aid to Iraqi refugees and is joined by the British. And in Israel, more concern. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. The U.S. military continues dropping humanitarian aid to Iraqi refugees stranded in the mountains of northern Iraq, about 200 kilometers from the Kurdish capital of Erbil. Three airdrops have delivered more than 52,000 meals and tens of thousands of gallons of fresh drinking water to displaced Christians, Yazidis, and other religious minorities who fled in fear of Islamic State fighters. Britain and France are joining the effort, and UK forces today made their first aid drop. British Foreign Secretary Phil Hammond.
Wherever and whenever U.S. personnel and facilities are threatened.
Okay, that would be President Obama. Let's hear from the British Foreign Secretary now.
At the moment, our focus is on supporting the humanitarian effort, trying to deal with the growing humanitarian crisis in Iraq, and waiting to see, as the new government is formed, whether it will be an inclusive government that we can get behind and support in its efforts.
The U.S. military says it has carried out four more airstrikes against Islamic State militants who were firing on the civilians in northern Iraq. The U.S. Central Command said the strikes this weekend involved jet fighters, drones, targeted armor carriers, and a truck, and it describes the strikes near Sinjar as successful. Palestinian negotiators in Cairo say they're discussing an Egyptian proposal for a new three-day ceasefire with Israel after warning they would leave the talks if Israel failed to return. The development came today as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the Jewish state would not come back to the truce talks in Cairo unless Hamas militants stop their rocket fire into Israel. We get the latest in this VOA report from Robert Berger in Jerusalem.
As Palestinian rockets flew across the border and Israel responded with airstrikes, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that the month-long offensive in Gaza will take more time. Speaking at the weekly cabinet meeting in Jerusalem, Mr. Netanyahu said the operation will continue until it achieves its goal, the restoration of peace and quiet for all Israeli citizens. He also said Israel will not return to ceasefire talks in Cairo until Hamas rocket attacks stop. In Cairo, Egyptian and Palestinian negotiators worked on a new three-day ceasefire and a longer-term truce. But Israel is not present at the talks. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A Ukrainian military spokesman has rejected a pro-Russian separatist call for a ceasefire as the fighting continues unabated in eastern Ukraine. The separatists said Saturday they were ready for a ceasefire to prevent a humanitarian disaster in eastern Ukraine, but today, the Ukrainian military spokesman Andrei Lysenko rejected the appeal and called on the rebels to raise white flags and lay down their weapons. The separatists themselves backed away from their ceasefire call, saying today that the Ukrainian government is incapable of reaching an agreement and therefore discussion of a ceasefire is pointless. China is dismissing U.S. calls for a freeze on provocative acts in the disputed waters of the South China Sea. The statement is being made with the backdrop of the foreign ministers at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Myanmar. Robin Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok.
The statement was made by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi, attending the meeting of ASEAN foreign ministers in the Myanmar capital of Naypyidaw. He warned Saturday that Beijing would react to what are being called provocative activities in the disputed waters of the South China Sea. In 2002, a regional code of conduct pact was viewed as a step to ease tensions, but China has rejected U.S. involvement. Foreign Minister Wang, speaking to reporters, restated China's position of protecting its regional sovereignty involving the South China Sea. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Millions of Turks are going to the polls, voting today in the country's first direct presidential election. Turnout is expected to be high. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is the frontrunner. If elected, he says he intends to change the constitution and establish an executive presidency. He has previously been accused of authoritarianism. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
It was a great success, and I think it was a wonderful gesture to signal to Africans and many Americans that Africans and Americans really need to work together for a common cause.
The just-concluded U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit is described as a signal for Africans and Americans to work together for a common cause.
We have not heard of any other mass exodus of any foreign nationals who want to leave the country. We are not in any state of panic in Sierra Leone. Everything is calm and life is proceeding as normal.
The struggle to contain the spread of the Ebola virus continues in Sierra Leone.
We have thought for a number of years that plants that have been used in traditional medicine might offer a new source of potential therapeutic compounds for neurodegenerative diseases.
And scientists look at traditional African medicine for the treatment of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The just-concluded U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington, D.C. has been described as a great success by the president of the Africa-America Institute, Amini Kajunju. I reached her in New York, where she summed up the just-concluded summit.
I think it was a great success, and I think it was a wonderful gesture to signal to Africans and many Americans that Africans and Americans really need to work together for a common cause. I think the Obama administration wants to show that they have a strong interest in the continent, and they want to facilitate business to happen. They want American businesses to find Africa as an attractive business destination, and I think all of those things, if they were to happen, would be wonderful for the continent.
You attended the Civil Society Forum and dialogue with African CEOs. Did you have a sense of urgency with those groups in terms of strengthening trade relations and promoting sustainable development in the continent?
I did. I did feel a sense of urgency because, you know, Africa is rising, but at the same time, there are some major challenges. We have a youth population that is growing. These young people need jobs. They need education. And I think one of the ways we can solve the problem of education and jobs is by creating businesses and by having big, medium, and small businesses being created, and then that will create jobs, and then we'll have young people who are productive. Otherwise, you know, this youth dividend could become, you know, a youth problem, and we certainly don't want that. And we've seen these issues all over the world, and so we want to avoid that on the African continent.
Now, some of the topics discussed at the summit were peace and security, trade and investment, and inclusive sustainable development. How optimistic are you that African leaders can work closely with their counterparts to put these into action?
It's a good question. I want to be optimistic, certainly. You know, as I was, I met a Cameroonian taxi driver in Washington who drove me from one hotel to another as I was attending meetings, and he said something that I thought was very insightful. He said, well, Amini, this is a great gathering. I'm in support of it. But if African presidents go back to their respective homes and nothing changes and the needle doesn't get move forward, there isn't, you know, something that they do that is different from what they did before, then this event has been without success. But the change has to happen once they get home and they sit in their respective environment.
Amini Kajunju is the president of the Africa America Institute. I spoke with her from New York. The spread of the Ebola virus in West Africa is a cause for concern. The World Health Organization has called the outbreak an international emergency. According to Sierra Leone's Information Minister, Alpha Kanu, the people are concerned, but are not in a state of panic. I reached him in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown, to find out about recent reports of international staff of mining companies and UN agencies and other foreign nationals leaving the country amidst the Ebola crisis.
I called the president of the Lebanese community, and he confirmed to me that there was absolutely no truth in that. There was no consideration by the Lebanese to leave, and we have not heard of any other mass exodus of any foreign nationals who want to leave the country. We are not in any state of panic in Sierra Leone. Everything is calm, and life is proceeding as normal. Yes, there is worry about the control of the virus, as we are still trying to trace contacts and all that to reduce infecting others. But other than that, we are not in a state of panic. The treatment centers are being put up where they were not, and those that are operating in Kenema and Kailam are operating in full scale, and we are hopeful that we are doing the right things in order to control the virus.
Reports emerged that Guinea closed its borders with Sierra Leone. Was that part of the agreement at the Mano River Union meeting last week?
Not at all. In fact, what the four leaders of the Mano River Union agreed, at least the leadership in Ivory Coast, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, they had agreed that since we are already in the enclave by Ivory Coast, that there was no point closing the borders between us. But what we would do is that we would control and restrict the movement of persons from one country to another in order for people who are being traced for contact not to travel from one country to the other in order to hide themselves. So, in fact, they had agreed that the lists of these suspects who may have been in contact with infected people and are not traceable may be given to the border points to check. And I think it is the reinforcement of that agreement that made people believe that the border was being shut. But, in fact, even in the evening, the ambassador of Guinea in Sierra Leone called His Excellency the President to say that they had made an announcement in Guinea that there was no order to close the border between Sierra Leone and Guinea, or Guinea and Liberia for that matter.
It seems as if medical personnel who are serving the community during this difficult period are getting infected at a rapid rate, and nurses are said to be abandoning the hospitals for fear of contracting the virus. What's being done to appease the medical community?
Well, I know that there is a meeting that's been slated for Monday, because we had a late meeting with the president yesterday, and that the medical management team, i.e. the minister and the doctors, have agreed to meet with the medical officers, the hospital workers, tomorrow to allay their fears that they will get more equipment supplied to them, they will get better protection, and of course incentives will be given for them. Yes, there have been some infections, but I think this was in the initial stages, because when unsuspecting people come to the hospital, they would not easily say that they suspect they have this Ebola virus, but then it turns out later on that they may have been in contact with an Ebola-infected person who may have passed it on.
Containment seemed to be one of the issues. How is that being handled at present?
Well, containment has been one of the reasons why the president declared a state of emergency. Initially, we had tried to explain to people that this was a contact disease, and what we must do is to try and reduce as much contact as possible, but because of the reluctance of some people who may have been in contact with others to come out and say that, yes, I was in contact with this patient, the areas around the epicenter have now been closed, so that movement in and out of that is now restricted and reduced to the barest minimum, only for essential supplies, so that they will be able to separate the infected from the non-infected.
Alpha Kanu is the Sierra Leonean Minister of Information. I spoke with him from the capital, Freetown. Scientists are looking at traditional African medicine for possible treatments for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. The Salk Institute for Biological Studies is analysing the leaves and bark of a tree that grows on an island nation off the coast of West Africa. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
On Sao Tome Principe, traditional healers have used the Voaconga Africana tree for hundreds of years. It's a small tree that produces yellow or white flowers that turn into berries and seeds. The seeds and bark have been used as a poison, aphrodisiac, and psychedelic. But traditional healers knew it somehow affected those believed to have brain disorders. Pamela Maher is a senior staff scientist at the Salk Institute's Cellular Neurobiology Lab.
We have developed over the years a variety of what are called phenotypic assays that mimic different aspects of what goes wrong in the aging brain. And we have thought for a number of years that plants that have been used in traditional medicines might offer a new source of potential therapeutic compounds for neurodegenerative diseases.
These include Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, as well as degeneration that occurs following a stroke. It's estimated as many as 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, which causes a 500,000 deaths each year.
Right now, there really are no good treatments for any neurodegenerative disease, and so we thought that by combining our phenotypic assays that can screen for potentially therapeutic compounds with new potential sources of therapeutic compounds might be a wonderful combination.
Serendipity caused researchers to focus on the Voa Conga Africa tree. While visiting his family in Portugal, Maher's associate, Antonio Carais, met Maria do Madureira, a researcher studying herbal medicine on São Tomé Príncipe for many years. They developed tests to find medicinal properties in plants.
We were focusing on plant extracts that were used in traditional medicine, either specifically for brain disorders or were known to have anti-inflammatory activity. And it's now known that a lot of neurological diseases, or almost all of them, involve some degree of inflammation.
The researchers found that the anti-inflammatory properties of the tree extracts were mostly due to one molecule called voicamine. No tests have been done on animals yet, but this is the molecule that potentially could lead to a synthetic drug for brain illnesses.
It was much more potent than we had expected something to be. So this showed that our approach for identifying these type of compounds works.
Maher says there are many potential sources of drugs in native plants around the world. Most of them have never been tested. She says since you cannot test every plant, the best approach is to use the knowledge that's been around for thousands of years to help pick and choose what to study. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As part of the Great Lakes Emergency Sexual and Gender-Based Violence and Women's Health Project, the World Bank signed a financial agreement of $15 million with the government of Rwanda. The project will provide community and health services for survivors of sexual and gender-based violence. I reached the World Bank's lead health specialist for Eastern and Southern Africa, Miriam Schneider, and asked her about the prevalence of gender-based violence in the Great Lakes region.
Violence against women has become really a major public health and development problem in the Great Lakes region. It has been used as a weapon of war during conflicts, but it continues well after the conflicts end. Just for example, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, nearly three-quarters of women report ever having experienced spousal or partner abuse at one time in their lives. That figure is nearly 50% in a country like Rwanda, where women report experiencing physical and sexual violence. The other thing which is important about violence against women, we're seeing the perpetrators are increasingly targeting children and youth of both sexes. For example, in both Rwanda and in Burundi, over 70% of the reported cases are under the age of 18. Survivors face numerous hurdles to putting their lives back together. They're often stigmatized, they're isolated, and they have a sense of hopelessness.
How would you describe the current state of services provided to survivors of sexual and gender-based violence in Rwanda?
In Rwanda, the government has designed a one-stop center model, and it's developed a national scale-up strategy with very clear objectives and target and budget. It has mobilized support from several partners, including UN agencies, the government of the Netherlands, DFID, and the Swiss Development Corporation, and is in the process of expanding access to services. So the one-stop center, which is called the Isangi model, and in Kenya, Rwanda, Isangi, read in English, Isangi is feel at home. So the whole concept behind the Isangi model is for women to come to one facility, which is a district hospital, and they have a dedicated center at that hospital where medical personnel, mental health professionals, and a deployed police officer offers all the services that a survivor needs at one location, making it more convenient and providing service with compassion, providing services free of charge, and providing more effective services services.
The World Bank has signed a financial agreement of $15 million to help the government of Rwanda provide community and health services for survivors of sexual and gender-based violence. How will the World Bank monitor this endeavor?
The World Bank works in close partnership with the government of Rwanda, who is our main client. We have close relationship with them. We provide intensive follow-up in terms of supervision missions, assisted supervision missions. We work in close collaboration with other partners as well. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the government is accountable for delivering these services, and it's really a partnership, and there's mutual accountability on both sides. We have a monitoring framework by which we monitor the results. And in this regional project, which also involves Democratic Republic of the Congo and Burundi, there will be knowledge sharing among the three countries. The three countries have a lot of common challenges. They have a common post-conflict history, and there's a lot that they can learn from each other.
Now, there's a lot of stigma associated with sexual and gender-based violence, and we know that there are some survivors who have not reported their ordeal. Is this program taking into consideration those people that have not come forward and reported their ordeal?
That's an excellent point. The one-stop center model in Rwanda and the provision of services in DRC and Burundi, the whole idea is to set up these centers to provide confidential, compassionate care in a private manner, respecting the rights of these individuals, and hopefully the establishment of the center will stimulate the demand. You know, the women and the girls, and sometimes the men and the boys who are affected by gender-based violence, will be more likely to come forward in the future when they see that there's access.
Miriam Schneidman is the World Bank's lead health specialist for Eastern and Southern Africa. She spoke with me here in Washington, D.C. Zimbabwe's First Lady, Grace Mugabe, is set to become part of the ruling party's highest decision-making body. Analysts say this move could dent the chances of Vice President Joyce Mujuru succeeding 90-year-old President Robert Mugabe when his term ends. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Over the past week, two of three key organs in Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party have nominated Grace Mugabe to lead party's women's section. That puts her in line to be part of ZANU-PF Central Committee, the party's highest decision-making body. She has since said she's ready for the new position. Opamu Chinguri, who has been leading the party's women's section, says she will step down in favor of the president's wife. She hopes factionalism and debate over Mr. Mugabe's successor will now become a thing of the past in ZANU-PF. Mushinguri says all the secret talks about succession will now be over. It is because we have given the burden to quell that to her. I know it is a tall order, she says. It is not easy because mother had been saying, I don't want to be in politics, but she was asked to join it. So mother, your children say lead us, she says. Some analysts say President Mugabe asked his wife to enter politics so that she can take over from the 90-year-old leader whose term ends in 2017, although he's eligible to run for re-election. Others believe he wants to position her as a counterweight to Vice President Mujuru or other potential rivals in the party. Mujuru and Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa are considered favorites to eventually take over from Mr. Mugabe, who has been Zimbabwe's leader since 1980 when the country won its independence from Great Britain. Pedzisai Ruhanya, who heads the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, says that at minimum, Grace Mugabe will become a significant figure in Zimbabwean politics going forward.
This is Grace expressing her realizing that the president is nearing his sunset in terms of his political career. Anyone who wants to take over from Mugabe must make sure that the future of the family is protected, must also make sure that if that person takes over from Mugabe, Grace must be found maybe as a minister or as an important figure in any future government after Mugabe.
On Friday, Mr. Mugabe addressed his party's youth conference but mentioned nothing about retiring from politics. On several occasions, he has attacked senior officials within ZANU-PF who have talked about succession, saying that fuels factionalism within Zimbabwe's ruling party. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Ugandans celebrating the repeal of the country's controversial Anti-Homosexuality Act gathered in a garden on the shore of Lake Victoria Saturday for a gay pride parade and rally. In contrast to a similar rally 2 years ago that was broken up by police, this time supporters of the country's LGBT community were promised protection. Lisbeth Pola has the details for VOA from Entebbe, Uganda.
Chartered buses packed with members and supporters of Uganda's LGBT community made their way to Entebbe's Botanical Gardens on the shore of Lake Victoria. The atmosphere was one of celebration thanks to this month's ruling by Uganda's Constitutional Court. The judges struck down a recent law imposing major penalties, up to life in prison, for so-called proven homosexuals. Many Ugandans still oppose homosexuality, but those at Saturday's rally said their message was simple: we refuse to be ashamed of who we are. Parade organizers worked closely with the police, who assured the marchers they would be protected from harassment if they followed a designated route. Still, some marchers wore masks to conceal their faces. Sean Mugisha, one of the organizers, explained why he was both happy and relieved.
Well, I think it's really exciting because this is happening after what happened in court. And security-wise, I think we're very safe because police is aware we're here.
Mm-hmm. Despite the court's action on August 1st, homosexuality remains illegal in Uganda, punishable by a jail sentence. But it is no longer illegal to promote homosexuality, and Ugandans are no longer obliged to report gays to the authorities. The court ruling was based on a technicality, and government officials say they will make another attempt to crack down on homosexuality, not to victimize gay people, as they say, but for the common good. Activists in the crowd of several hundred people at the Botanical Gardens said they were demonstrating for their common good. They marched behind some of the best-known leaders in Uganda's gay community, including Pepe Julius Onzima and Kasha Jacqueline Nabagasera. Nabagasera made her position clear.
Next time we shall be marching on the streets of Kampala Road. I'm wearing this mask not because I don't want to show my face, but because of my comrades who, for obvious reasons, cannot show their faces.
Emotional marchers screamed, cried, chanted, and sang as they moved down the road. Park visitors stood by staring. Two women who declined to give their names said they approved of the parade.
We feel so proud that we are having this pride here because we didn't expect it. We are so proud of the activists and we thank them for standing up for us.
And we are proud of ourselves.
And we are so happy this is happening. We don't mind whether it's short-lived, but we are happy today.
Some Ugandan lawmakers say they hope to reintroduce the anti-homosexuality bill later this year without softening the harsh penalties it imposes on homosexual activity. However, one of the signs carried by the marchers seemed to sum up their feelings. We are here to stay and won't stop until you stop. Lisbeth Pola for VOA News, Entebbe, Uganda.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll review and discuss the historic U.S.-African Leaders Summit with two of its key players, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the top U.S.-Africa diplomat, and Florizel Lizier, the assistant U.S. trade representative for Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, music from our African continent for our listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah from our UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, August 10th. Let's start off with African club football. Tunisian club Esperance is out of contention for the semi-finals of the 2014 CAF Champions League. The Tunisian giants played 2-2 with host team Anton Setif of Algeria in Group B match day 5 on Saturday. The result was enough to give Anton Setif the group's second ticket for the semi-finals. Setif joins Tunisia CS Sfaxien, which secured his place earlier on Friday after a lone goal victory over Ali Benghazi of Libya in Tunis. This is the first time since 2010 that Esperance, which won the competition in 1994 and 2011, has failed to reach the semi-finals of Africa's Premier Club Football competition. It is also the first time since 2010 that an Algerian team has reached the last four of the CAF Champions League. Sfaxien now has 10 points, Setif 9, while Ali Benghazi and Esperance have 4 points each. Turning to Africa's other club football competition, the CAF Confederation Cup, Egyptian giant Al Ahly on Saturday failed to ensure its progress to the semi-final with one match to spare in Group B after a lackluster display saw the team lose 1-0 away to Zambia Sankana. The Red Devils, who are seeking to become the first Egyptian side to win Africa's second-tier club competition, were undone by a dubious second-half penalty from Billy Nwanza. It was the first group stage defeat for Al Ahly. The Cairo Giants are scheduled to face Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel on August 23rd to secure a place in the tournament semi-finals. Al Ahly is still on top of the group with 8 points, one ahead of Nkana and two clear of Ivory Coast Civil Sports, which defeated Etoile du Sahel 1-0 also on Saturday. Ali's Spanish coach Juan Carlos Garrido has apologized for the loss and promised to defeat Etoile du Sahel in their final group game. Let's now head to Canada, venue of the ongoing 2014 FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup. Africa's two representatives, Ghana and Nigeria, have contrasting fortunes. While Nigeria is looking very good for the quarterfinal, having won one match and drawn one, Ghana faces an uphill task to advance to the last eight after winning one match and losing one. Nigeria leads Group C with 4 points, after drawing 1-1 with Mexico and beating South Korea 2-1. A draw for Nigeria in this final group match against England on Wednesday will be enough to see the Africans through to the quarterfinals. However, Ghana, which is third in Group A on 3 points, needs an outright victory against Finland on Tuesday to have any chance of advancing from the group stage. Meanwhile, Nigeria's Courtney Dike scored the fastest goal in the history of FIFA women's tournaments, after she took advantage of South Korea's lackluster defending to score in the very first minute of the match against South Korea on Saturday. Nigeria won the match 2-1. DK was starting her first match of the tournament after coming on as a substitute in the opener against Mexico. Away from the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup now, a team of inspectors from African soccer's governing body, CAF, is in Zambia to assess the country's potentials as a future host of the Africa Cup of Nations. The 5-member team arrived in Zambia on Saturday. It will visit stadiums in the capital city of Lusaka and 4 other cities, Chingola, Chililabumbwe, Livingstone, and Ndola. Zambia has constructed new stadiums in both Lusaka and Ndola with a capacity of some 60,000 each. The captain will also inspect training pitches, hotels, hospitals, as well as transport and communication networks. Zambia is among the 5 countries bidding to host the Nations Cup in 2019 and 2021. The team has also visited Guinea, Ivory Coast, Algeria, and Cameroon. Last week, the Democratic Republic of Congo withdrew its bid. The future hosts will be picked by CAF next month. The next Africa Cup of Nations will be staged in Morocco in early 2015, followed by Libya in 2017. And MC Alger beats rival USM Alger on Saturday to win the 2014 edition of the Algeria Super Cup. Midfielder Sid Ahmed Awad scored the only goal of the tournament in the 80th minute at the Mustapha Chica Stadium in Blida, located southwest of the capital, Algiers. The tournament is played between the winners of the Algerian Professional League One and the Algerian Cup. This is the third time the capital-based club has won the title after 2006 and 2007. Finally, Ivory Coast striker Didier Drogba announced his international retirement on Friday after scoring 61 goals in 103 appearances for his country. The Chelsea forward played for his country's national team, nicknamed the Elephants, for 12 years, playing in three World Cups and twice helping the team to finish runner-up at the Africa Cup of Nations. Drogba, who was brought up in France, won his first cap against South Africa in 2002. He played in 8 international tournaments, but never as part of a winning team. During the last 18 months, Drogba's talismanic role in the national team has been reduced by the decision of coach Sabri Lamouchi, with whom he had a strained relationship, to bench him for key matches and leave him out of others. Drogba's decision came just days after the Ivorians appointed Frenchman Avi Renard as their new coach. I cannot convey enough thanks to the fans for all the love and support during these years. All my goals, all my caps, all our victories are for you. I love you, Drogba said. This is wishing Didier Drogba good luck in his future endeavors. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. We'll be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports here on Nightline Africa.
Metro Studio Internationale, Saidi Komori Mwana Komoro, Ali Choki Mzee Kujinafas, Frem Joshua, Toto ya Mwanza, Papa Musofe.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Wakizidi unakomano. Hata wasemi sana. sanae wewe waone ni bure Maria wana sema sana wengine rafiki wa karibu kwa kuwa wanakutambua wewe ni mtu wangu msisitizo na kueleza Papa Musofe uepukane nao uachane nao uashiti kabisa wakizini unakomana uepukane nao uachane nao uashiti kabisa wakizini unakomana
bakawa Murusuku aneni baba kwa sebiye seno Nachaka waba mokamba mirango mubezi Nijoshiri mwakakano
was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here's Dr. Joner.
Good evening, Africa. Ebola has rapidly become a dreaded word to millions of Africans, particularly the population of the three West African countries that have been most infected with the terrible virus. It conjures a long journey to the unknown, and all that is wrong and inadequate in the health system in the three countries. As the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, observed, these countries only recently emerged from a long period of civil conflict, and they have weak, fragile health systems. Even those that have been in denial are now waking up to the grim realization that Ebola is real and it kills in large numbers. It should be taken seriously. The president of Liberia and Sierra Leone have gone so far to raise the alarm that the continuing spread of the Ebola virus threatens the survival of the states and people. As an international health worker in Sierra Leone aptly asserted, Ebola is pretty scary. This is not the first time that the international community became aware of the Ebola virus. The disease first surfaced in 1976 from the dead body of a Belgian nun in the Congo. Fortunately, it was contained and confined to a small area. It did not infect a large number of people. This time around, it is different. The Ebola virus was detected in Guinea in March this year. It soon spread to the neighboring countries of Liberia and Sierra Leone. Some have suggested that the international and the national responses were too slow to contain the Ebola outbreak. However, there has been a change. Even with their meager resources, these governments have taken some actions. States of emergencies have been declared, and they have quarantined communities and used the armed forces and police to control movements, and have launched significant information campaigns to advise and inform the population as to how best to behave and meet the adverse challenges, one of which is the fact that at this stage, the disease is incurable, although some have recovered. Regrettably, these governments are up against a serious clash of modernity and tradition. There have been some reluctance on the part of the people to take seriously or believe that the Ebola virus is real. Accordingly, they have failed to follow directions of the governments. Now, WHO, following a two-day meeting of health experts in Geneva, announced last Friday that the Ebola virus outbreak was an extraordinary event and declared that owing to the virulence of the virus, the intensive community and health facility transmissions pattern, the spread of Ebola in West Africa is an international emergency. Although it was stressed that it was not meant to convey the idea that it was spread globally. All the same, the authorities in Nigeria have observed that even though Nigeria has not borders with the three countries in West Africa, the Ebola virus was transmitted to Lagos, its commercial capital, through air traffic. President Barack Obama even had to reassure the American people that participants from those countries attending the Africa-U.S. summit would be screened properly before the entry into the United States. The toll of the Ebola virus has been heavy. More than 1,700 cases and over 930 dead. In the midst of this crisis, there is the dilemma facing health workers. Initially, they encountered opposition from the uninformed population. Now, following a large number of deaths among health workers, they are now hesitant to continue their work in clinics and in hospitals. Many are staying home. Hopefully, with the arrival of international assistance, such as protective gears and trained personnel, they may be persuaded to return to their noble activities. It has been suggested that experimental drugs should be used, but one should be cautious at this stage. What is necessary now is robust international efforts to tackle this terrible epidemic. I thank you.
That was Dr. James Joner. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoy the program. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With nations in West Africa facing the biggest and most complex outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever in history, the United States is stepping up assistance to confront the disease. An additional 50 U.S. disease control specialists will soon travel to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the nations at the center of the epidemic, to provide technical assistance and help health officials there with emergency operations. They will also help bolster medical laboratories in the region that test for the disease and help screen air travelers to identify passengers who may have been infected. Top U.S. health officials discussed further aid with leaders from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria who are attending the U.S. African Leaders Summit in Washington this week. Medical supplies and expertise are badly needed to combat a disease that has killed at least 900 people and infected more than 1,700, African officials say. There is no known cure for Ebola, which is spread through contact with bodily fluids and causes symptoms including fever, headaches, vomiting, and diarrhea, and can lead to internal bleeding. Supportive care, such as replacing lost fluids and administering drugs, can improve a patient's chances of survival. Two Americans who contracted Ebola while working in a clinic in Liberia are receiving experimental antibody treatments after medical evacuation to the U.S. If further testing proves the antibodies effective, they may offer hope against future cases of the disease in Africa. But they are unlikely to be ready for widespread use in the current outbreak, medical experts say. U.S. health agencies responded quickly to requests from West Africa when the scope of the problem was known. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention coordinated testing of samples from suspected cases of Ebola infection. The U.S. Agency for International Development is funding a mobile laboratory in Guinea that can quickly do tests in suspected cases of the disease. Under another USAID grant, protective equipment is being provided to healthcare workers treating the sick. Monies have been provided to fund a public information campaign to help people protect themselves from infection. Such health crises threaten us all and require a wide-ranging international response. As seen in efforts on other health threats such as HIV, AIDS, and malaria, the United States is helping lead the way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.